Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And now for something completely different. Ophira Eisenberg is here. She's host of NPR's new quiz and puzzles show, Ask Me Another. And she's in town for a special taping of the show at the Wilbur Theater tonight. Here's a little taste.
I don't know if you've ever walked in and your husband or boyfriend has done the laptop slam. And I saw that happen and I was like, whoa, what is that about? And then he was gone the next day and I know he doesn't know how to clear his browser. So I'm like, I'm going to bring up his history and see what porn this guy's looking at, you know? And I know he's not looking at pictures of girls that look like me, right? He's looking at the opposite of me, right? He's looking at big, blonde, busty Christians.
Now, as I said, the show's called Ask Me Another. So, Ophira, I will. I've obviously got a bunch of questions. I'm going to begin with this one, though. Just how many sexual partners have you had?
This is not the kind of question we usually ask on Ask Me Another, but it's a good trivia question for me. Now, I'm going with the number 40.
40.
And they were, for the most part, all pretty good people. I'm not going to lie. They were pretty good people.
So this is part of the explanation behind why your new memoir is called Screw Everyone, Sleeping My Way to Monogamy.
It's fun to say.
We had a little bit of debate on whether or not we could actually even say that
yes,
on the
radio.
Yes, I
know. This is a thing few people have had to check. Turns out you can say it like one or two times.
Okay, so there's my first one.
Yeah.
But actually, on that note, before we continue, I do feel compelled to say, because a lot of our listeners are in their cars driving their kids home from school.
Sure.
At this hour, we're going to talk about some adult themes, namely sex.
Yes.
And so it might not be appropriate for everyone, but that said, Ophira, I'd love to hear a little bit from your new memoir. Why don't we start by having you read an excerpt from it that gives us a little window into your general attitude about sex.
Sure. Call me an enthusiastic consenter or a fairly responsible hedonist, but sleeping around was often the byproduct of getting what I wanted. I felt empowered going against the accepted rules of society by intentionally going home with a guy. And they weren't just random guys. I picked them. That being said, I was an advocate of equal opportunity hookups from everyone from jazz musicians to blind albinos. Oh, the memories. Right from the start, I planned and strategized my potential romantic encounters like a veteran criminal. My quest in life went beyond wanting to try anything. I wanted to try everything. Sex and relationships became my drug of choice, and what turned me on the most was the seduction. The thrill of trying to get someone to like me, see how far I could take it. Rarely was it a problem to get the ball rolling. The issue was how to control it once it picked up speed. By my estimation, dating was 1% confidence and 99% troubleshooting.
That's Ophira Eisenberg reading from her new memoir. Okay, so Ophira, I've got to ask, there's a lot of ways to tell a person's life story.
Yes.
Why'd you choose to tell it through your adventures with, you know, the various people that you've met?
The relationships.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's true that some people jump out of planes and some people enjoy rollerblading. I defined myself or figured out who I was by relationships. I really was drawn to being with people based on thrill-seeking. So this was one way to tell my story, and I realized at some point in my life, I think about the time I got married, that I'd been with a lot of people, and I really kind of figured out who I was through that, because I didn't know who I was.
Mm. Okay, so let's start when you had that first whiff of that thrill.
yeah.
Age 11?
Your first
kiss.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I'm taking you way back
here.
Yes.
So, Brad Moore, Valentine's Day party in the basement, and Brad asked me to dance, and then we're under the Cupid. And I remember my heart racing, like, what is going to happen? It was so exciting. I couldn't believe that I was about to kiss this guy, that I liked that guy. I mean, in hindsight, maybe it wasn't great, but my memory was it was advanced. It was an advanced technique, and I replayed that moment in my head for years.
So your hormonal revelation treated you well. Others of us went screaming down the hall.
Yeah,
in the
maybe
opposite
right
direction.
There. Right, I was just like, more, more, more. I want more of this. I like this.
All right, so let's talk about what more meant a little later in your life as you grew up, because you hit the comedy circuit, right?
Yes.
And you end up doing, in the book you talk about, you end up doing a gig in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yes.
A successful time for you, but you also describe yourself as being pretty lonely.
Well, going on the road and being alone, especially I believe as a woman, is just a very lonely. I as a stand-up on the road, you're working alone, and then you have this really weird combination of events where you're alone, you have no one to talk to because you don't know anyone. Then you go up on stage and you are talking to a huge mass of people. And then afterwards, you have no one to share that experience with because only you had your experience from your perspective. You deal with it a lot of different ways. But one of the ways that you always hear a lot of the guys treat it is they hook up. And so in this particular story that we're talking about, I decided I would do the same.
All right, well, let's hear a little bit more about how you write about it in your memoir.
I arrived at the club on the desperate side of early. When I hit the stage 2 hours later, I was transformed into everyone's best friend for the next 45 minutes. It was such a relief, and I left the stage sporting a nice, comforting buzz. As far as I was concerned, my only post-show obligation was to keep that high going, so I headed straight for the bar and threw $20 on the counter. I found myself scanning the faces at the bar, all of them men, looking for someone to flirt with, someone to play with. This wasn't about choice. It was survival. And then I spotted my target, a tall, lanky bar back who seemed like the silent type. I grabbed my beer, wandered over to him, and said, "Are you like the dark horse of this place or something?" That was my opening line. It sounded so much better in my head on the walk over. It's harder being a guy than it looks. He smiled back, which disrupted the whole dark horse thing, as it revealed he was really young, like early 20s. If I squinted, mid-20s. He was no dark horse. He was a dark pony. But he was my dark little pony.
That's Ophira Eisenberg reading from her new memoir, Screw Everyone, Sleeping My Way to Monogamy. So, Ophira, I have to say, I had so many laugh out loud moments when I was reading your memoir. But at the same time, the courage with which you share all of these stories,
yeah,
it kind of left me traumatized. Because I'm thinking, this is a lot. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
I just have to flat out ask you, was there ever any point in your life where you were wondering, why am I doing this? Am I a sex addict, maybe?
No, I never thought I was a sex addict at all. I feel like there's this idea that if you are promiscuous or you have a lot of partners that you're unstable or undone or maybe dumb or coming apart at the seams in some way. I never felt that way. I really felt like I thrived on connection when I met these people, and the seduction, the thrill, the chase, that was important to me. And there was loneliness. I'm not going to say I was a perfectly formed person, but it was never about just nothingness. I wanted the connection. I never looked back and went, wow, my number's really high. I just went, I'm just doing what I'm doing to try to, I don't know, feel something in this cold world.
But you eventually do feel something.
Yes, and there was a point too, especially when I moved to New York. Now, New York, I like to say, you know, when I lived in Canada, I thought Sex and City was a comedy parody show. I didn't realize it was a documentary. I mean, you're thrown rules, first of all, because all these women have rules. They're like, don't call them there. I'm like, what are you talking about? And then, as luck had it, I stumbled across a guy that was an exception. And I'll tell you, the exception of, it wasn't like I ran into James Bond or Indiana Jones. My husband is very good looking and very cool in the nerdiest way. But he was nice and just seemed like the kind of person that would be loyal and didn't lie for fun. And all these things that you think are, that's the minimum, bare minimum, but that ended up being the exception.
Which is thrilling in and of itself.
It's totally thrilling, but it was the right time too. I think if I met that guy, 2 years before that, when I was more interested in how late can we stay up and what weird adventure can we go on, I wouldn't have appreciated it.
Yeah. So in the book, you tell the story about the moment in which you think to yourself, all right, I'm done. I don't maybe want to seek other kinds of thrills
yes.
so much anymore. It's just a really great story. I was wondering if you could share that with us.
Yeah, I did a gig in Pennsylvania that did not go well, and I have no replacement therapy, and I'm at a loss. I don't know what to do, but I'm not going to jeopardize this relationship just because I feel bad after failing on stage. So I take a bus ride home, I walk into our tiny little apartment, and it's clean, suspiciously clean. And I know a lot of people in relationships know what I mean. You're like, wow, why are the socks no longer in that vase? And he's made dinner. We just sat down and talked, and then he started folding, took out a piece of origami paper and started folding it into a crane, which sounds very odd. But Jonathan's into the Japanese art of folding paper. And he starts talking this very presentational voice, like he's addressing a crowd. He's like, you know, there's all these stories in Japanese folklore about cranes. Like if you give someone 1,000 cranes, it will bring them hope. Or if you give someone 1,000 cranes, it will bring them good fortune. And he goes, but the one I like the best is if you give someone 1,000 cranes, your love will last forever. And then he finishes folding it and he hands it to me and he says, this is number 1,000. And then he directs my eyes to this box. This box had been in our closet for years, and I was told I was not allowed to look in it. But he pulled it out, and he said, look in the box. And I opened the box, and inside the box were 999 paper-folded cranes that he had been folding throughout the years as an exercise, first in patience. And then later, he heard about this 1,000 cranes, and he wanted to get there, thinking when he got to 1,000, the love of his life would be standing before him. And there I was, smelling like a bus, but there I was. And it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. I don't think he realized at the beginning where he would end. So in that, in his way...
Well, neither did you.
And neither did I. So while he's folding the cranes, he doesn't really know where it's going to go. And as I'm bouncing around from futon to futon, I don't know where I'm going either.
So in writing this book and looking back at all those futons...
Yeah.
What was that like for you? Was it sort of... You know, was it an enjoyable reliving of memories, or were you at times thinking, I'm looking at someone else's life?
It was, I mean, at times, for just remembering some of the heartbreak and remembering the confusion. Like, I did all of this stuff. I did my research. I approached it like a social scientist, and I found a little thing about myself. And at the end, I found, based on all of that knowledge, I was able to identify the right match for myself. Let's hope it lasts forever.
Which is all anyone can hope
yeah,
for.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
So that's what, that was my way. If you can find that right at the beginning, though, do it. Save yourself a lot of time.
Well, Ophira Eisenberg is host of NPR's Ask Me Another. You can catch a live taping of the show if you go tonight to the Wilbur Theater. She's also got a new memoir out called Screw Everyone. I think that's my official third time saying that. Sleeping My Way to Monogamy. Ophira, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was delightful.
And by the way, don't forget, you can always follow us on Twitter. We're at Radio Boston. Or if you want to send me a message, you can follow me as well. I'm at Meghna WBUR. That's MEGHNAWBUR. That's it for today, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.